How well are governments in Oregon, particularly the municipal government of Portland, confronting the inclement weather that has descended on the state? How responsibility are government officials confronting disproportionate impacts on Portland's houseless community? What is the basis for societal attitudes toward the houseless population generally, and are they based in compassion or even accurate information? What lessons can grassroots activists learn in terms of how to engage elected representatives in taking action on matters of life and death? Is the Portland emergency a harbinger of developments to come as climate change takes its toll on North America? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of a major weather emergency threatening Portland, Oregon, and surrounding areas, we spend the entire show speaking with Portland resident, poet, and longtime earth activist Mimi Gurman about the desperate situation facing her city's most vulnerable residents, the poor responses of city officials, and the practical actions being undertaken to save lives. On this week's program, Portland in a Storm, a case study of confronting the human impacts of abrupt climate change. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 3rd, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. So convinced are aides to U.S. President Donald Trump that the EU is on the verge of a breakup that they recently asked EU officials over the phone which countries will be next to leave the bloc after Britain. In the meantime, the man tipped to be Donald Trump's ambassador to the European Union has told the BBC the single currency could collapse in the next 18 months. Even the creator of the euro, Professor Otmar Issing, has predicted that Brussels' dream of a European superstate will finally be buried amongst the rubble of the crumbling single currency he designed, accusing Eurocrats and German leader Angela Merkel of, quote, betraying the principles of the euro and demonstrating scandalous incompetence over its management, unquote, pointing a finger directly at Mario Draghi's failing monetary policy. Economists, commentators, experts, and pundits are now divided when it comes to the survival prospects of the euro in the near term, and even that fact alone has considerably worsened since last year, with the head of the ECB, Mario Draghi, admitting an eventual breakup is a possibility. Probability is that much higher than previously ever imagined. That comes from the article, Crisis of EU Banking, Breakup of the European Union, ECB Head Mario Draghi, by Graham Van Bergen, posted January 31st, originally appearing at True Publica. It was presented by Russia's foreign minister in Astana to opposition leaders who rejected it. What remains unclear is how this initiative emerged and what mechanisms of consultation prevailed between Moscow and Damascus. It is highly unlikely that the Syrian government would accept this initiative. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, acknowledged that the draft was based on the input of, quote, the Syrian government, opposition, and regional powers, unquote. The Syrian authorities have not made any official statement regarding this mysterious document. That comes from the article, Syria's Draft Constitution, prepared by Moscow without the approval of Damascus, posted February 1st. General Motors had encouraged Fuyao Glass to move some production facilities to the U.S. in order to lower costs. This is one example of a Chinese company bringing jobs to the U.S. However, it is unlikely to dissuade Trump from taking a tough line against China, even though economists say that the availability of cheaper labor elsewhere is not that critical in explaining the decrease of manufacturing jobs in the U.S. As in other countries, the largest problem is the number of jobs deprived because of technological improvements, Michael Knoll, co-director of the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Tax Law and Policy, told Who What Why. Studies have found that U.S. manufacturing lost 5.6 million jobs between 2000 and 2010, but only 13% of the loss resulted from international trade, while 85% was attributable to automation, according to the Financial Times. That comes from the article, Guess Who's Moving Factories to America to Lower Costs? China seeks a Made in America label, by Yitzhu Wang, posted February 1st, originally appearing at Who, What, Why. Alexandre Bissonnette liked the military, liked weapons, and had learned how to handle them in the Army cadets. An often shunned loner who trolled the internet, he disliked feminists and feared and disliked Muslims. He is probably like many of the other young people elsewhere in the world, rudderless in the New World Order, who have taken up arms in the past 20 years and committed senseless, politically motivated, violent crimes. It is true that Alexandre Bissonnette is a Quebec homegrown terrorist, yet, just as homegrown vegetables can only be as organic as the surrounding earth and atmosphere allows, Quebec's homegrown terrorist is also a product of the New World Order that has been foisted upon us all. That comes from the article, The New World Order Hits Quebec City, Islamophobia, an Instrument of America's Military Agenda, by Robin Philpott, posted February 1st. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler declared states of emergency on January 11th in the wake of severe winter storm conditions that include immense dumps of snow that's wreaked havoc on highways and caused dozens of power outages. The houseless population are particularly affected. In Portland, there have been 5 deaths so far, including that of a newborn child. On the ground, activists are trying desperately to get official authorities to intervene and provide emergency shelters for this most vulnerable population before more deaths succumb to the inclement conditions. Mimi Gurman is among those on-the-ground activists in the city of Portland. Global Research NewsHour listeners may remember her from a previous interview we conducted with her related to fallout from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. She joins us now to talk about a different catastrophe, as much related to political neglect as climate. Welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour, Mimi.
Thanks for having me back. I love your show.
Thank you. Mimi, as I understand it, the mayor is ultimately responsible for emergency measures in the city of Portland, and you have attempted to engage him a number of times on addressing the houseless crisis. I believe it was last Wednesday, January 25th, when you shut down City Hall, citing the need for immediate action, and you were promised a meeting with the mayor. And when I last spoke to you a couple of days ago, just shy of a deadline you had set for a meeting to take place, can I ask what has taken place since then?
Well, after the shutdown last Wednesday, the mayor said that he would come and speak to all of us outside following City Council, and he did. And at the end of that City Council, at the end of that session when he came out to talk to us, I told him that I was going to call him to arrange that meeting, and he said, please do, and he gave his communications person was with him, whose name is Michelle. So Michelle gave me her number, and I called her first thing Thursday morning to set up an appointment. She tried to route me to a computer to do it on the computer. I said, no. I said, we're going to do this together as humans. And she put the request in in the proper channels so that I could find out when I would have that appointment with the mayor. And she did tell me that I'd hear at the beginning of the following week, which was this past Monday. So I didn't hear anything on Monday. She told me that I should call her if I didn't hear anything. So I called her Monday, and she said, okay, I'll check in on that and, you know, call me tomorrow, which would be Tuesday, if I didn't hear anything. So I didn't hear. She wouldn't even answer on Tuesday. So now I'm not getting phone calls answered. I'm not able to talk to anybody. And I went to the mayor's office to see if I could talk to her directly, and they kept me away from her. So at that point, I decided, fine, we'll have to go shut down city council again to get our point across, which is specifically that we need more emergency shelters planned and prepared before we have weather events. Whether those weather events are winter events or heat events, which are going to be coming in the summertime. So once again, the city failed to prepare, and we are now in a winter event. It started yesterday. It was freezing cold out. We're supposed to get snow today, an ice storm, things like this. And the mayor refused to meet with me. So he actually evaded meeting with me. So yesterday morning at city council, we decided we'd go in and interrupt city council again to bring attention to the fact that we need an emergency session right now for emergency shelters. Well, the mayor shut down the council, and we ended up not being able to talk to the mayor. When I was thrown out of the council, so I wasn't even allowed to go back in for the resumption of the council. So when they went back in, I was in the hallway. My friends were inside. They decided to interrupt again, and they shut down city council one more time, again with the to make the council deal with emergency shelters. In the process, Chloe Udaly, who was just voted in on the council, who's actually for the people, her office came to me while I was sitting outside banned from going into city council and asked me if I wanted to talk to her office about what we knew was necessary for shelters. And I said, sure, I'll come to you. So we went in and we had, I don't know if it's a couple hours of a talk with Chloe's office, which was really productive. And the bottom line from Chloe's office is she can't demand to have shelters open, but she can pressure the mayor to get shelters opened. And we went through our list of concerns and had her office recognize what the problems have been with shelters. And one of the issues that the government was thinking was a problem was that there wouldn't be enough volunteers if they opened more shelters. So let's just open fewer shelters and see if we can get volunteers for them. And we'll sardine and stuff in the houseless population into rooms that are, you know, filled with sick people because they've been living on the street, people who haven't been able to shower, people with belongings in bags that tend to get either stolen or lost in the fray. And I said, you have to open more shelters, and of course there will be volunteers for those shelters if you ask for volunteers. So the city has never gone on television or any news media to say we need volunteers to come forward now if we're going to open more shelters and make this more humane for people living on the street to get shelter. So that was kind of like news to them, you know, oh, we can actually get volunteers if we ask for volunteers. So there's a new app that Chloe's office put out, and I haven't had time yet to go through it to see where any glitches might be, but it's a positive step. And again, this is coming from Chloe's office, not the mayor's office. And Chloe does not have the ability to open more shelters. So again, the mayor's doing nothing. He's done nothing all along, and there have been 5 deaths since he took office. The death started on his first day. So that's where we're at right now. We're getting some help from Chloe's office. We're getting no help from the mayor's office. The mayor's telling the community through media that he's willing to talk to anybody to get help with this issue of houselessness and emergency shelters, and yet he doesn't talk to any of us. So, and in the process, when we do confront these issues and we do take these issues to the street, what the mayor does then is he engages the cops to come in full riot gear and really damage people out on the street who are trying to get heard and exercising First Amendment rights to, you know, express whatever it is they want to express. You know, wrongs that our government's doing, wrongs that our local government's doing, wrongs that our mayor is doing by having police come out in riot gear, suppressing our right to be on the street. So this is our mayor, and this is our situation. And now we're, again, in a an emergency crisis, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're talking about these conditions go back quite a ways. I mean, you're having unseasonably cold weather and a lot of, compared to what you're used to. I wonder if maybe you could help acquaint our listeners with the acute conditions that those people that you've been in touch with on the street, the houseless population, as you call it, not the homeless, but houseless population, people who don't have adequate shelter, how, some of the situations that they've had to confront to basically help acquaint our listeners with the acuteness of the problem. I mean, we've heard about the five deaths, but, you know, maybe that's sort of like the day-to-day challenges that they're confronting that the mayor appears not to be addressing adequately.
Sure. We have people sleeping outside, not even necessarily under boxes, but just in open air, next to highways, next to busy roads, anywhere where they can be out of direct contact with the sky above them. So we have people under underpasses. We have people hiding in doorways, seeking shelter from the winds. We have 50-mile-an-hour winds right now. It's been coming since yesterday, and it's freezing out. The people who have tents are a little bit better off, but when you see the winds blowing and you feel the winds blowing, I couldn't sleep last night thinking about everybody who's out on the streets. We have people in fields outside trying to get shelter underneath trees. We have limbs falling off of trees. We have trees falling over. And this is where people are trying to survive. Mm-hmm. So not everybody has blankets. Not everybody has enough blankets. One blanket won't do. Living outside won't do. Everybody here, there's over 4,000 people living on the street here. Everybody here needs to be treated in a humane fashion in places where you aren't cooped up with 60 to 100 people in one room when no churches have been asked by our mayor to open, when no community centers have been asked to open by our mayor. We do have means to deal with this, to bring people in, to transport people, and that's the other issue. People on the street don't know where these shelters are. They're just trying to survive and get through this. And so it's our job, all of us, to be able to go out and find everybody and ask them if they want to come to shelters and then get them to the shelters. They can't get from where they are with their bags of belongings, which is all they have, to a shelter. It's just not possible, and it's not going to happen. Again, whether they're sick or not, whether they have mental issues or not, they're not going to get themselves there because they can't. There's too many miles in between where they are and a shelter is. So transport was a big component of what we were pushing the mayor to do, which is we have an entire fleet of vehicles, and each vehicle here says Portland, the city that works, which is a terrible irony right now. And none of those vehicles, not one, we have cars and trucks and vans. Not one of those cars or trucks or vans are going out to locate people. If I know where they are and my friends know where people are, why can't the city go and pick these people up? It's not about that they can, it's that they won't, that they don't either don't think about it, don't care to do it, or say, we don't have money to do it, because everything always comes down to this excuse about money, which is totally, it's total bullshit. You know, we don't need money to do that. You need some gas money. The city has money for that. So transportation has been a really big issue, and it's still not being dealt with. We have said as well that the cops' job should be to, when they see people on the street, to first find out if they're okay, and then ask them if they want to go to shelter. And if they do want to go to shelter, to get all of their belongings into their police vehicles, get the person into the police vehicle, and take them either to the shelter that's nearest to them or to a hospital if they need, you know, hospitalization for dehydration, for malnourishment, or for, you know, being out in the weather. So whatever that is, we need all of these city officials doing their jobs, and no one's doing a job. It's been the grassroots folks who are doing the job once again, and of course we'll continue to do that. And we're also proof that we don't need money to do that. We're going to do it anyway. And that's what we've been doing. But it's been a real disgrace that not only have five people died, but we have so many people living in this weather. I'm looking out my window right now in the luxury of having a roof over my head, thinking about everybody who is absolutely suffering outside.
I'm wondering if if you could maybe address the question of intersectionality. Are you finding that that you've got beyond these conditions, that there's certain attitudes that prevail against those people who are without shelter and without adequate shelter, that they're being dealt with in some sort of a judgmental way? Is that presenting itself as a part of the problem for the mayor and the city council to address, and police to address?
Well, the police don't like anyone. So, as far as they go, that's a whole separate issue. If you're in need, the police aren't going to help you. That's just the rule. And apparently it's the rule across the U.S., or so it seems. But regarding everybody else, and it's not just an issue of government officials, it's an issue of people. People are afraid to communicate, to talk, to smile, to ask anything when they see somebody living on the street. I ask people now, it's just a thing, it's just a curiosity thing, a little sociology game that I play with people, which is to ask them, do you ever talk to people you see on the street? I know you see people on the street. Do you ever say, hello, how are you? And I said, no. And I asked them, why? Well, because I don't know what to say to them. I'm like, is that your reason? Or is it because, you don't want to deal with this, knowing that there are people who are hurting so badly or are so in need, and you feel like, how would I even help them? Whatever the issue is, people don't want to acknowledge that there are people on the street who are human beings. So we dehumanize the situation. We don't talk to people on the street, because if we did, we would be humanizing it. And it's much easier to deny when we've completely dehumanized an entire subject, and we've subjugated that group into nothingness, then we feel better. So it's a sickness, I think. It's a social sickness. It's a caste issue. People think that the caste system is only in India, and we have our own caste system. And the lowest, the bottom of the caste system are the people who live on the streets. I noticed during the Women's March here that of the issues that people complained about that weren't coming up at the Women's March, there were issues of, in Portland anyway, there were issues, and I think this was more a lot more widespread than just Portland, but there were issues where it was mostly white women who were concerned about white women's issues. And those white women weren't concerned about, during the march, for people who were, let's say, in wheelchairs or less able to do the march. How are we going to make space for those people? The other issue that came up often was, what about, where are the people who are organizing who are non-white women? And that was a big problem. So we see these issues over and over again with two groups that come in, but we never see the issue of houselessness. Because again, we pretend it doesn't exist. So why would we even think to say we need rights for people who are living on the street. And those rights are that everybody should be able to have a roof over their head. Mm. That should be a right, that we should be able to live safely. But those issues don't come up, especially for white women. So when we talk about intersectionality, I saw that all day long, well, even for weeks long, in the process of this, you know, Million Women March coming together. And I thought it was despicable. I thought it was narcissistic. I heard from people who understand me that, yeah, well, at least people who have never protested before got out to the street to protest. And I said, I don't buy that as an answer. You know, that so therefore it's a good thing. I don't think it did much. Mm-hmm. Where are those white women now? What are they fighting for now? Are they on the phone? Millions of people, are they on the phone talking to politicians to get their way? Is it working? Was it effective? What are you doing about people who have less than you? And the answer to that is nothing.
What are you hearing from the people who are, you know, confronting this, from that houseless population? What are they telling you about the efforts or lack thereof of the government to provide them with their needs?
It's an entire lack thereof. And this is directly from the people that I talk to. I talk to everybody I meet. And there's not one person I meet who I don't have a discussion with about this, because I want to know. And the issues are that there's only one building in Portland that is a, it's called TPI. It's a place where people can go to shower. It's like the only place where people can go to shower. But they also have offices there that can help you, you know, get certain things, get certain needs met. If you need to have, you know, a different program working with you, they can help connect you to that program. But it's a bureaucracy. So while it's supposed to do something, because it's a bureaucracy, it doesn't do the thing that it's supposed to do. So the people on the street who know where they're supposed to go to get their needs met, they also know that when they get there, their needs won't be met. But they have to go there anyway, because if they don't go there, they can't go anywhere else. So it's a complete lose-lose for them from the very point of go, which is go to this building. So there's that. There is no housing. There are no places for them to go to try to get help. There are people who are, you know, drastically mentally ill on the street. And, you know, we see this in any large city, and small cities too, where there's no help. Why are these people on the street? Where is that social worker? That's what I want to know. Where is their social worker? Well, if the answer that we usually get is the social workers are overloaded, and my response to that is, if you're a caring person, figure it out. If you've got too many people, figure out your week so that you can at least follow the people that are on your docket, or however that works. Go out to the street and find them and do your job. And if you can't do your job, do something else. So there's that. It's just, it's a complete scale of inhumanity. And on one end of the scale, it's 100%. And on the other end of the scale, it's just denial.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We will hear more of our conversation with Mimi Gurman about how her fellow Portland City residents are confronting the weather emergency in their city. But first, I wanted to alert regular listeners that CKUW, the radio station that hosts the Global Research News Hour, will be airing a live broadcast on February 17th at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. This program will be geared toward raising funds for the station. CKUW, which has been in operation for over half a century, nearly 18 as a broadcaster on the FM band, requires the support of listeners who appreciate our unique blend of independent news and views, as well as the diverse variety of independent artists that we showcase each week. CKUW does not benefit from government funding and does not run any paid ads whatsoever. CKUW is situated on the University of Winnipeg campus and benefits in large part from a levy on student tuition. Otherwise, we are totally dependent on support from community members. If you value this program, please consider a donation to CKUW or to any community radio station that chooses to run the show. For more information on how to donate directly to our station, please visit fundrive.ckuw.ca. I understand that it's really can be easy, relatively easy for people to be evicted from their abodes, and that this is also a factor in this is that the extent to which rents can just be jacked up. And people, including those who you are, referring to as among the mentally ill who are, requiring of assistance, are left, falling through those cracks, which appear quite easy to fall through. Apparently, can you speak to that reality that, that this could happen to many more people than they might realize?
Yeah, it is happening to more people every day here. And I met a woman the other day on the street. I had two tents in my car that I needed to give out to people. And in my process of driving around, I was downtown in Portland. I saw a woman crying on the street. And so I pulled over to ask her, what was going on and could I help? And she was devastated. She had worked at a kind of a large store here called Winco for 20 years. And she had a no-cause eviction. This was in September. And we have those here, no-cause evictions. So your landlord can just tell you you're out. And that's it. You're out. Well, she didn't have enough savings to get herself elsewhere. And she ended up, when I saw her, she had a room at the Salvation Army. And she was crying outside the Salvation Army. And when I found out that she had room, at least for 25 more days, she said, "What do I do after this?" And I said, "Well, there's a person in Portland who did open a shelter. He's not city related. His name is Menashe. He's a wealthy man and he owns a building and he opened the building up for months now so that throughout the rest of winter, as long as there are spaces, there's an allotment of spaces, as long as there are spaces, you can get in and stay there." So I was telling this woman about that and I know where she is and I can go back and help her prepare for that. Today in city council, I don't know if it's a city council thing, it might be a county thing, there's going to be a vote on can we make landlords responsible to pay for the all of the payments for relocation for people that they evict. So that vote is coming in today, and it's an important vote, and it will be taking place at 2 p.m. today. So I'll be over there. I'd like to see how that turns out. And there's also going to be people there who are landlords saying that they don't want that to go through because they really like no-cause evictions. Mm-hmm. And we can't at the moment create a law against no-cause evictions. That's something that Chloe is trying to do, and I think she's just recognized that she's not going to be able to do that. So they're trying to figure out ways that we can, that the city can provide immediate help for people who are victims of no-cause eviction or extreme rent increases and therefore back out on the street. So this is something, again, Chloe. Mm-hmm. Chloe got voted in because we knew that she was an advocate for people. She's an activist. And this is what we have to do on local levels if we want any sort of change to happen now, is get activists onto your boards. I don't care much for public school at all. I don't think it's an effective place to send your kids. But if you do, get your friends on the school board. If you care about current law, get your friends elected to the city council. And that's what we're doing. and we have plans to get everybody else out of the city council, including this mayor. So we're hoping that he's just another one-term mayor. Mm. We have a slew of them right now because they're so ineffective, and we challenge them so hard they don't want to be the mayor anymore.
Yeah. I don't know if there aren't some sort of, you know, systemic or other pressures involved, because, I mean, I did look a little bit at Mayor Wheeler when he was running back in February. He claimed, like, he put out this big plan for addressing the homeless or the houselessness situation. And it doesn't seem as if he is adequately responding to the concerns that you've raised, especially in light of the demands you put out a couple of weeks ago or more about specific demands, calling, okay, here's some stuff we can do now. We can open up emergency shelters.
Right, like opening the community centers, right, and making the churches, even shaming the churches into opening their doors if that's what it takes. Using our fleet of vehicles to transport the houseless folks to shelters. Yes, all of these things. Using our cops without their weapons to help transport people, because they do. And what they do instead is they sit in their warm cars and watch activists take care of the people on the street. I mean, this has happened so many times in the last month where activists have seen cops sitting across the street, watching them in the freezing, freezing weather, helping the houseless to, you know, with whatever they need, whether it's bringing them food or blankets or whatever, and the cops sit in their cars. Mm.
Mm-hmm. And there is at least one community center that's been turned into an emergency shelter?
No, there's okay. One community center that I was pressing, the issue of community centers. And we were here in St. John's, which is where I live. We needed our community center to open to help relieve pressure on one of the churches that was opening as a shelter but couldn't maintain its open status throughout everything, even though the person who works at the church really wanted that to happen. There were other people involved who wouldn't let that happen, so it wasn't like a 24-hour shelter though it should have been. So in order to help with the process to not continuously move people to different shelters at different points in St. John's, the community center was right down the street from the church, and I've been pressing and pressing this since December to open community centers, since Christmas. And it wasn't happening. And then the city, and I was directed to this person in particular, this guy Mark Jolin, who apparently people who own nonprofits love. Mark Jolin is a gatekeeper. Mark Jolin is in charge of opening community centers, apparently. And he was supposed to get us a bus for transport for 60 people from one church to another church because the community center wasn't open. So it's a two-mile span on a freezing, freezing snow, ice. You can't walk in this. This was a few weeks ago. And so he said, we will get you a bus. And we were making plans for this from as early as 9:30 that morning. And it turned out that the bus never existed. And I was being lied to all day long. I was being lied to by a nonprofit group plus Mark Jolin's group. And so what we had instead were 60 people with all of their belongings who needed to leave that church. They couldn't leave anything in there, to walk 2 miles in the freezing cold with snow and ice. I mean, ice was everywhere, to this other shelter where I was, at which point Mark Jolin called me to tell me that, well, there's not a bus, but I'll send a cab. And all the highways were iced. No one was moving anywhere. So as people were coming in, I was still on the phone with Mark. And I told Mark that he's a failure. His group is a failure. The city's been a failure. And, you know, thanks for lying to the people. So this is how our city functions in crises. And they say that they're planning now for this earthquake that will come at some point sooner than later, I'm sure, the big one. They say they're planning for that. They can't even plan for 4,000 people to get from where they are to a shelter because they don't have shelters set up for the people in time to move and transport the people to the shelters. So I know that when this earthquake comes, there's going to be nothing for anyone as far as safety or, you know, anything like that. There won't be buildings. There won't be a place. Nothing will be in plan because our city doesn't know how to do that. And it's very clear right now that this is the case.
Now, I want to make sure we mention at least one initiative. I understand that this was, you mentioned this to me previously, and it was reported in the Willamette Week that there was a $350,000 expenditure that was geared toward addressing this situation. I think it was Councillor Fitz who...
Right, Amanda Fritz.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So could you give our listeners some details as to what was involved with that expenditure and what it achieved?
The expenditure was about $350,000 that was supposed to go to talking, and it said this in the title, to communicating, to having a conversation about what we can do for the houseless community, what we can do about getting homes for the houseless. $350,000 for a conversation. The conversation was going to be with all of the gatekeeping nonprofits. So those nonprofits would be contracted out through the city to receive, I think there were two that would get $80,000 just to be part of this conversation and have the time spent doing that. So I think part of that money was used for that conversation, and part of that money wasn't used because people kiboshed the continuance of this crazy conversation worth $350,000 rather than action in current time, live time, helping people who are on the street. And the thing is that we have organizers here who make tiny homes, who devote time, and they donate tiny homes to becoming villages for people living on the street. But our city doesn't really allow space to have these villages come into being. So supposedly there's one that's supposed to come into being in North Portland, which is also where I live. We just call this whole area North Portland. And it will be a great thing if this actually happens. But we need tiny home villages all over our county and beyond. We need tiny home villages throughout the United States, and we need to understand what community really is and how to create community in villages like this. And we have one now called Hazelnut Grove, where it's not that tiny homes were necessarily given to them, but they made their own tiny homes out of materials that they were given so that they have some shelter. And there are about 28 people, 25 people to 30 people who live there, depending. And it's a community unto itself. And it is also, they've created their own laws to live by. And sometimes it works well and sometimes it doesn't. But that's community. So the community needs to deal with that. Their community needs to deal with that. And there are those of us who support that community. And I don't mean financially. I just mean, you know, these villages need time to grow and become accustomed to how do we live together again. These are people who are coming off the street who haven't had housing for a very long time and all of a sudden are now living in a village. But we need these villages to be able to come up. You know, we don't need huge houses. We can take the houses that have been foreclosed upon at the banks own and we can have people move into those. We can have the banks forgive that. Forgive the debt or whatever it is, and allow houseless people to move in and get a new start. There's lots of different ways where you don't have to put money out in order to fix a problem. But our city, like most people in most cities and most governments, only work when there's dollars in front of them. And they can't figure out how to work without that dollar thing getting in their way, because the dollar thing gives them the excuse to either move forward or not, and it's usually not. So they don't know what to do with me when I go to city council, because I'm not going to them with I need money or I have money. I'm just going with ideas to fix things, and so are my friends. So they really can't figure out how to deal with us and then choose not to and choose to call us whatever it is that they call us. You know, we're a bunch of radicals who understand community and understand that you cannot allow human beings or stray animals to live outside in these conditions. You have to take care of each other. And this is how we do it.
I wish I could give you a little more time to kind of highlight some of the acts of heroism, you know, notwithstanding what the government is or is not doing. That you mentioned to me places where people are just donating. I think you mentioned a place called Port 134, where people are donating, and there's people who are getting hot meals out to folks.
Right, Free Hot Soup. Mm-hmm. Free Hot Soup is an incredible organization put together by radicals during Occupy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, could you just maybe give us, like, is there one maybe specific example of heroism that they could really inspire people across the country and maybe trigger other similar acts that could actually get stuff done?
Yeah, there's three. I'm going to go in the other room because this phone is ringing out here. There's three, and one is Free Hot Soup. So Free Hot Soup makes sure that people can get mobile in their vehicles with 5 gallons of hot soup to take out to people living on the street. Or in cases like this, when there is an emergency shelter set up, they can also take the Free Hot Soup over to whether it's a church or whatever, and feed people there. So that's one example. Another example are friends of mine who get pounds and pounds of potatoes. They bake them, and they wrap them, and they take those out along with blankets and things like this and hot chocolate and tea and coffee to people out on the street. Now, they're not necessarily part of Free Hot Soup. They're just people doing things that need to be done. There's a woman who is elderly who lives near me who is constantly asking her friends for more donations of warm clothing and blankets and sleeping bags and tents and socks and hats and gloves. And then she calls me to say, can you come pick it up? Because she's elderly and she can't get out. So I pick it up from her. So these are people who are doing so much for the community, who aren't taking a dime, who don't have a nonprofit, who aren't using money to make this happen, who are helping people directly on the street.
Okay.
And anybody can do this.
Mm-hmm. And the other, you know, 1-2 punch, if you will, the other side of it is trying to find a way of working with the politicians. And even if that means shutting things down, in order to address a crisis, can I get you to say a few words about how politicians, as much as they can be part of the problem, if there's maybe a secret formula for how to get them to work in a productive way as opposed to being part of the problem?
Well, we're just starting to see the productivity coming out due to our actions from the city. So it's a process, but we need to hasten and speed up the process. And so the easiest and quickest way to do that is to have all of your either demands, excuse me, or answers ready, and you go in with a specific issue and shut down whatever it is you need to shut down and bring attention to your issue. And what we did was they complied pretty much right away by giving us a meeting with the mayor outside. It was a public meeting. But the mayor gave us empty words, which was expected. So when he did that, I followed through on what he asked of me to either get that meeting with him or prove that he's just lying. And then we have the right again. Well, we've always had the right, but we chose to use our right to shut down city council one more time to see if we could get our answers heard, because our answers are for the people on the street. And after the second time, as I said earlier, we were received by another city councilor's office. And she is working with our ideas and moving forward with, hopefully, pressuring the mayor to use his power to get on TV, to get in media, to shame these churches into opening, to demanding that community centers. We can't do that. We cannot make a community center open. We cannot make a church do their thing. But the mayor could. And so you have to just think about the system and how to use the system to work for you. And when you figure that out, go do that. And the key for us is always that we are the power. So use your power and then bring that and show the people who have a different set along with power to use theirs in a constructive way that's going to get what you know needs to happen done. And that's what we're doing.
Okay. Mimi Gurman, I know that you've got to get moving now, and I do very much appreciate your taking the time to speak with us. But in the couple of minutes we've got left, is there anything else, any loose ends that you really want to make sure our listeners know about, whether it's you know ways to help either people in Portland or people across the country? I mean, stuff that we really, the lessons we could learn from your own struggles there, that they could help inform what we, improving the country and the world.
Well, I think one of the things is to stop denying what is going on and what isn't being talked about. So abrupt climate change is not being talked about by hardly anyone. Our issue right now here is abrupt climate change. We haven't had winters like this. We're having a second coming right now in one winter of what we had a few weeks ago, though we won't have the same amount of snow. But we don't normally get this cold in one winter, let alone twice in one winter. So we're dealing with that, which, back to intersectionality, who is that going to affect first? It's going to affect people on the street. So think about how climate change is going to affect where you are. That's really my message right now. Look at who's being affected and get ahead of it as much as you can for the time being right now. And if you know that this is coming your way, which it is, start to deal with the people who are most in need. And those are the people living outside. And use your power and think about your power and question everything and don't ever trust authority.
Mimi Gurman, I want to thank you very much for this chat, and I wish you well in your ongoing efforts out there in on the West Coast, and all the best.
Thank you so much. Thanks for giving me this time to talk to everybody.
I've been speaking with Mimi Gurman, who's been one of many activists who have been involved in trying to assist the emergency situation facing the houseless population in Portland, Oregon. This program is dedicated to the five individuals who lost their lives in the midst of last month's winter storm in Portland, as well as to the numerous unsung heroes in the city rising to the challenge of making sure that these will be the last to perish. Next week, we will produce a special program dedicated to the months-long Standing Rock resistance and some of the underreported dynamics surrounding it. We hope you'll stay tuned. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also broadcast Thursday evening on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can download our podcasts from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm program host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. We'll close the show now with a theme-appropriate song. This is the song Big House, a track from the 2010 release Indians and Clowns from the band Miriam's Well, featuring Mimi Gurman on vocals. Thank you for joining us, and stay tuned for your next regularly scheduled program.